So, welcome to day two. Clearly the main theme is containment, so maybe we could sort of try to put some flesh on this, so to speak, and really see how we can deal with it on a day-to-day basis. Now, the most ideal conditions for practicing containment is unquestionably to have a daily routine. A daily routine means that usually through a job of work, which I think probably most of us have got, I'm sure we have, most of us anyway. where we have more or less a timetable in our life. So we have a time when we get up, and we have a time when we go to work, and we have our routine at work and various times, generally speaking. This is a general overall. If you don't exactly fit into this archetypal daily routine, still use it as a pointer. We always have to have reference points, whatever we're doing. So we have our job of work, we have the time that we get to work. We start work and what we do at work and our breaks, and we come home and we have our commitments at home, and the general framework of our lives, of our normal, everyday, ordinary lives. And if we can use that as a starting point, as a framework for the practice of the Dharma. So we get up, we have our routine before we go to work, and maybe off we go. And this routine that takes place day after day after day can very soon become a little bit tedious, possibly, or at least it has its period. Even if we're doing a job that we like, we still have periods, I'm quite sure, when it gets a bit tedious and we feel like, you know, we're doing something that maybe we would rather not be doing, but we have commitments, so therefore we fulfill our commitments and we carry on as best that we can. At those times when the tediousness and the difficulties arise, this is where we can start to really engage with the Dharma. The Dharma generally is engaged with, nurtured and cultivated, actually in times of difficulty, much more so than at times when life is peaceful and pleasant, to be enjoyed, of course, but actual dharmic change is very much in the more difficult times. And so if we just take an example, maybe anything you like really, of just simply getting up in the morning, say we get up at whatever, 6-7 o'clock, the alarm goes off, we wake up, and often maybe we just get up and carry on, but at other times we find this incredibly difficult. We don't actually want to get up, and maybe if we don't practice the Dharma, maybe we actually give in to this inertia and this aversion to actually dragging ourselves out of our nice warm bed, and so we indulge, we become self-indulgent and just lie around and do what we would rather be doing. But when we practice the Dharma at these times, rather than give in to those periods of inertia and negativity, and this is the great thing of routine, that we know that we have to get up in order to do, to get ourselves ready to be at work, for example, at a certain time. So rather than give in to that inertia, we actually take ourselves out of bed. And that can be quite a difficult thing. And it's not just a mental experience, as I'm sure most of us would agree. It's actually, we can get quite an emotional impact of real negativity, of real resistance, of really, really not wanting to do this. Resentment, maybe. Why do I have to keep doing this every day? And that really is an emotional impact. And I think this comes back to what we were saying yesterday, of this practice really is about focusing much more on the emotional side of ourselves. So in that time of this emotional resistance and emotional impact, which again, as I say, can be really quite a physical experience, instead of giving in to that and just lying in bed, going back to sleep or whatever, we actually get up with that emotional experience, with that emotional impact in the body, and actually retain it. Rather than give in to it, actually get up and just live with it, carry it, keep it within ourselves. Unpleasant though it may be. And carry on and function and do what we have to do, what we normally do at that time of the day, prepare ourselves. And learn, rather than, as I say, to initially give in to that resistance, but actually learn to carry that emotional impact, that emotional resistance. And to the best of our ability, to do the things that we do in our routine and to function as normal and as human as possible. And this can be really quite difficult because we don't want to do it. And we have this very unpleasant physical aspect of that unpleasantness that we learn to carry with us. And we learn to open to that. And we learn to live with that. And not to try and engage with that resistance and the thoughts and the pictures that come up, and just to increase and strengthen that negativity till we end up feeling really awful, that then spills over onto other people. If we happen to be living with other people, we can then take it out on others, and others can see that we're in a unwholesome state, shall we say. But learn to carry that. Learn to carry it and learn to function as normal and as humanly as possible. Of course, this isn't easy. And in that normal functioning, that normal, if we are interacting with people, this is where the great virtue of the positive precepts come in, where we can actually, rather than just sort of feeling sorry for ourselves and sort of curling up into a little ball, we actually engage in the normal way and actually nurture those positive precepts, which help us to engage in a human way with life and with other people. But all the time that we're doing this, we are actually learning to carry around this resistance. And it really is very much a physical, it is very much in the body. Learning to stay with that, learning not to allow it to rise up and carry us back into our old habits of inertia and negativity. This demands self-awareness. We always have to be alive and aware to ourselves at this time. If we lose that awareness, then we will fall back into the old habit, back into the old way, and we'll be caught up in it before we even realise. And very often, once we actually fall back into that, we can't get ourselves back out of it. It's like it's run away. It's like you can liken it to a wild animal that you are tethering and keeping under control, that you just slacken yourself for a moment and the beast runs off. And once it starts running, it has too much energy, too much power for us to simply stop it. So this is the necessity of awareness, which is crucial to the containment and is crucial to the practice. Everything is impermanent. If we learn to stay with this and stay with these negative impulses, negative reactions, and carry on and function as best we can inside our daily structure. And this is the great thing about having a form, is that whether we want to do things or not, we actually know at certain times of the day we do this and then we do that. And that really does, actually, we can resent it an awful lot, but actually it can be an incredible support and help and guide when we start to be overwhelmed by these forces. They can actually help us to work with these difficulties. If we stay with these emotional outflows, and we really can contain them and stay with them, they will change. It will have this thrust. But if we truly stay with that, with this experience, as I tried to touch on yesterday, energy is dynamic. It is always moving, and if it can't express itself in its normal habitual way, it will actually turn over and ultimately it will go into change. But certainly in the short term, it will also go into change. But there is a bigger change, shall we say, that takes place over time. Now, in that whole experience of containment, what we're doing is that we are really opening up to ourselves. we are giving that experience room within ourselves. This is not because we don't give into the old habit. It doesn't mean to say that we are avoiding ourselves. Far from it. But these times here, what we're doing is that we give that experience lots and lots of space within ourselves, and with our awareness. Which is necessary in order to keep it tethered, should we say. With that awareness, we become very much more aware of ourselves. We begin to get to know ourselves. We begin to get to understand ourselves. Whereas before, we were caught up and carried away by something that we had little control over and little real knowledge of. Really much a sort of enslavement, really, to something that would just... a habit that would kick in and take us away. Now we're actually not buying into that. We're not crushing it or pushing it away, but we're actually just gently holding it, gently keeping it within ourselves. And we're beginning to look into that, and we're beginning to understand it more and more. And eventually, I mean, this is the path of discovery, the path of self-discovery, the path of knowing ourselves. Little by little, through knowing ourselves more and more, and through the taming of that of those powerful emotions, things begin to change within ourselves. And little by little, that change takes place. Now, the difficulty we have is really just staying with ourselves and just actually becoming acquainted with ourselves. This can be very often quite an unpleasant... In one sense, it's a very wonderful, illuminating experience. But at the same time, there may be parts of ourselves that rise up, part of the negativity that maybe let's just look on the negative side of ourselves. I'm sure we've all got nice positive sides as well, nice light, bright sides. But let's look at the stuff that we feel really needs to go into change. And maybe we see aspects of ourselves that we actually really, quite frankly, we don't like. We might see them as being quite destructive just to ourselves and our relationship with ourselves. and that energy that we collect is really trying to get you to fall into that trap of actually not liking yourself more and more, so that energy can rush into that situation and you can really get really develop an incredibly negative view of yourself and a very negative relationship with yourself. And the more we buy into that, the more we give into that, the worse it will get. And also, not just the relationship that we have with ourselves, but also relationships with others. And we can see that. We can see that it's destructive. We can see that it's unwholesome, that it actually is really very damaging. There isn't really anything of any value in it for anybody. And through that containment, we actually begin to see that more and more. And that can be a very, very difficult thing to actually take on board. We actually really don't want to know those things, even though we're caught up by them, and we know we're fully aware that, you know, what these things can actually do. Somehow, we never really want to confront it in ourselves. And through containment, this is what we're doing. Confronting doesn't mean that we get in conflict. It means that we are prepared to actually really, really open and look at that. Look at those things. Look at those things that are very unpleasant and that we don't like. And in that opening and looking, this can be incredibly difficult. And generally speaking, I would say it would be fairly common that most of us, most people in the world, in life, don't really do that, don't really engage in that. And actually life generally and society actually encourages us really not to really engage with that, but really to really lose ourselves. The things that we get involved with, it's all about avoiding ourselves, about being caught up with entertainment or being just totally continually diverting through materialism, etc. So there isn't anything that this isn't the sort of natural order of things. But in the quest within this practice, which maybe we've all got different motivations, but the process, whether we like it or not, actually comes via getting to know ourselves. And unless we are prepared to actually get to know ourselves, which means to commune with ourselves, open to ourselves, not avoid ourselves, then change will never take place, not real change. And the whole containing process is really a process of getting to know ourselves, of learning to accept the very, very starting point of all of this, the starting point of change, is to accept ourselves the way that we are. And that is not easy a lot of the time. Accepting ourselves the way that we are doesn't mean that we just carry on as we've always been doing, but to acknowledge that we are not maybe what we would really like to be. And to learn, rather than react to those parts of us that we don't like, react to them, either we indulge in it or we run away or we suppress, whatever we do, but to actually open and actually learn through opening, through accepting, through staying with what we are actually doing. We are actually beginning to get to know ourselves and to get to like ourselves. And there is something inside of ourselves that is not interested in that. And there's something that really gets very, very threatened by the whole prospect of actually getting to know ourselves. Because the entrapment that we all experience is fundamentally, it fundamentally comes from the fact that we don't actually know ourselves. We act, we live out of this whole deluded idea that we create for ourselves. It actually isn't the truth. It isn't the way it really is. But by learning to contain these outflows that we experience from early in the morning to through our daily life, through our daily routine, and learning to stay and not to fall into the old habits, not to buy into the old habits, the old reactions, but learning to contain all of that and to function and carry on. Oh, it's 9 o'clock. At 9 o'clock I do this. At 12 o'clock I do this. This is the value of a form that actually guides you. Just learning to stay with yourself and learning to open up and get to know yourself. And in that getting to know, it is a process. It is not an engagement of dialogue with yourself and a talking to yourself of, oh, you shouldn't be like this, you should be like that. It's actually just opening and getting to know and getting to see the way that you are. And that is the key. From that point there, things can begin to change because slowly you begin to get to know yourself. And in that getting to know, that whole habitual stream starts to change. Now this is the thing that we have to learn, the thing that we have to learn is the containment, is actually not to fall into the old habitual ways, but just learning to stay with ourselves. When we fall into habitual ways, our old habits, which are not just actions, they can be views and opinions and this and that. What we're actually doing there is that we're creating and we're nurturing the sense of self. Now, I don't think the self actually, although we seem to think that the self is like one thing, as it were, I think actually the self actually manifests in our habits, whether they be good habits or bad habits, or whether they be, just simply views and opinions, or actually things that we do. These things that we've actually cultivated and fallen into, these habitual ways that we seem to have actually very little, if any, control over at all, it's an ongoing process of reaffirming me. I exist, I am here, I have this view, I have this opinion, I don't want to do this, I want to do that. It is a perpetual cycle, a perpetual ongoing reaffirmation of this sense of me, which is self-centered and ultimately only cares about itself, and it will do anything. Ultimately, the self is capable of anything that will reaffirm itself, protect itself, nurture itself. And if we look into all of that, we can actually see that this is really, really the cause of suffering. And it's the transforming. We don't actually transform the self, because ultimately it's questionable whether there's a self there or not. But it's the habits, the ingrained habits that we fall into, that actually allows that sense of self to arise. If we can truly transform the habits and our old habitual ways, then where is the self? But the nature of the self is that it will fight its corner, and it will always be reasserting itself, and it will always be trying in some way to express itself. And this is what the actual containing process is actually about. And through that change of habits, or through the burning out of those habits through containment, Quite truly, that this is where the self actually dies. And this is the way the dharmic process works, until ultimately, when we truly transform that driving emotional energy, which creates the habits that we then identify with, that we then get caught up and carried away with, When that habitual negative energy actually does transform, this is when we go beyond self, this is when we go beyond ourselves, and this is when we really do taste freedom, when we experience freedom, when we are free from the bonds, from the bondage. And our true original nature that we actually all live out of can shine forth, no longer bound by this sense of self. Now, once the self begins to feel, once the self can't express itself through our containment, and we learn to contain our habits, it can become extremely difficult. Apart from just the simple fact of actually containing ourselves and not falling into an old habit, soon enough things even beyond that particular experience can rise up. We actually sort of open up, what we're doing is we're opening up ourselves to forces that are actually just below the surface, and these can be, at times, can be quite difficult. We can have dark forces and experiences of fear and loneliness and all these things that we find very difficult to experience. We don't want them, we run away from them, we divert ourselves from them, and this is why we cause so much trouble. And in fact, when we do that, actually what we're doing is that we're just actually increasing all of that. And through the containment and through the opening and accepting, we're actually beginning to learn to accept those dark forces, learning to come together with those forces, the fear, the loneliness, and learning to bear with and to stay with, learning to bear with those very difficult experiences. But if we can bear with those, if we can truly bear with those, with aliveness, with awareness, and with our developing insight, because we are alive and we are open, we are actually beginning to understand ourselves, and we're actually beginning to, as I say, what we're really doing, we're really beginning to make friends with those forces. And when we make friends with those forces, this is where change takes place. And as I was trying to point out yesterday, this whole process, everything that I've been saying here this morning up till now, this whole process, trying to paint a general sketch, a general picture, all of this takes place inside of your form. This is not a mental exercise. This is very much a physical exercise. And the whole experience that you are experiencing is actually taking place very much deep within yourself. And learn to stay and learn to live in that place where this experience is actually taking place. And this is very much in the body. This is, as I say, this is not a mental exercise. We're not working this out with our minds. We're actually living it. We're carrying it around. It is a part of us. And we're learning to open, and we're learning to understand and accept. And the more that we can accept, the more that we can stay with and accept, this is where we truly make friends with ourselves. And that friendship goes beyond friendship. It then comes into the true love, the true loving of ourselves. And in that true loving, and in that true understanding, as we go deeper and deeper, we actually find that when we do truly make friends with ourselves, and we do truly love ourselves, we will quite naturally, we will quite unavoidably actually accept and love all of life, all people, all situations. So that what may seem in some ways to be a sort of a selfish practice actually embraces the whole of life. And actually ultimately isn't selfish at all. if we can all just reflect on that and actually look at ourselves and look at our lives and how we live our lives, I think we can begin to maybe identify with what's being said, and we can make it very personal and see that this is actually a living experience. This is when we go beyond the theory, when we stop taking notes and listening to talks and reading books, etc., but when we actually get up in the morning, our actual real life starts there, and that impact, the impact of all of this actually takes place, that we then learn to live with and work with. This is where the practice of the Dharma is. This is not the thinking and the theorizing of what is the taste of an ice cream. Spend your life wondering what the taste of an ice cream is actually like. This is when you put the ice cream in your mouth and you actually know as a direct experience, beyond thinking, beyond theory. This is when you actually know. And this is where, to me, this is where the Dharma is actually, this is where you taste the ice cream. This is when you know. And this is where genuine change can actually take place. And I think we soon discover, really, when we're going along with this, the difficulty of it. The difficulty of actually not falling into our old habits. Mental habits, physical habits. Because habits are incredibly powerful. And the habits, certainly these habits, can't be changed by an act of will, because they're simply too strong. We have to, as it were, exhaust the energy, the power that creates these things. And this is what dharmic practice will do. It will transform the life of those habits, so the habits become weaker and weaker and weaker, become more transparent, not this all embracing, this all powerful thing that we have no control over, but actually it becomes weaker and weaker. So we can actually, as it were, look through the habit. And then eventually we can just, as we were touching on yesterday, these habits can actually quite often fade away, and we're not even aware of them. Little by little, it's so subtle that they can actually fade away. And it's maybe only in the future, when we come back into an old familiar situation, that we discover that we don't act in the same way as we've always done, but we've never really been, we've lost sort of awareness of it. And it's only when we come back into that, oh, I don't think like that anymore, I don't react like that anymore, I don't do that anymore. But the change has been so subtle, and Dharma change is subtle, and it takes time. It's not a great burst of light and music, as often these things are portrayed. It is a very quiet, very subtle transformation that is so subtle. Most of the time, we're not aware of it. We can, in hindsight, realise that things have gone into change, but actually, it can be even more subtle than that. Because that we can actually identify that change. But actually, I think there's an even more subtle change that actually takes place even beyond that, and that we're never actually aware of it. We can't ever actually ever pick it. We can't sort of grab hold of it. We can get some sort of an intuitive thing that things aren't the same as they were 5 years ago or 10 years ago or whatever. But even then, we can't put our finger on it. That's the real change. That's the real Dharma change. And that change is nothing to do with you. And this can be very frustrating. I want change. I want to know what I've got for my efforts, what I've got for my money, as it were. I want to know what this change is. But I'm afraid the Dharma's not interested in your desires to be different and to change. That change is beyond you, is beyond what you create. You cannot create this change. It takes place on its own. And it is subtle, and like I say, sometimes we may get inklings, but a lot of the time we will never actually know. And that's how it works. And you see how much different that is to a worldly change, when you actually bring up your will and you hammer yourself with something. I am going to give up smoking. And you absolutely, and it's really conscious, and you just absolutely determined over the period of time, and then eventually you actually do give up smoking, and you say, I've given up smoking. And you really, really know you've actually changed a habit. But the Dharma's not like that. It's much more subtle than that. So this daily engagement, again, as we were saying yesterday, is not something that you can turn on and turn off when you feel like, oh, I don't want, oh, I'm okay, yesterday I contained and I got out of bed and but today, oh well, today, oh tomorrow I'll get back into the containment, and today I won't go to work, I'll go back to sleep, and I won't do the things that I know I should be doing. Mañana, it'll be okay, we'll come back to it tomorrow. This really doesn't fit. The whole process of change is very much a consistent commitment, as I keep saying, a wholehearted consistency day after day after day. And it's when you truly engage in that consistency in a nice gentle way, not a full-on forceful way, because if you force this, soon you'll run out of energy, and soon it will actually just fall to pieces on you. In the same way that if you actually are too laid back and too casual and too inconsistent, that too won't work. There's a middle way between those two. There's a gentle commitment that you are going to embark upon this as a daily practice. There's all your experiences, all the experiences that we have in the day, not these ones, yes, and those ones I won't engage here, and cut it up and make it all sort of piecemeal. But a gentle but firm commitment to engage with what we're doing day after day after day after day. And when you don't want to do it, when you're really, really fed up, just bring yourself back to it. Bring yourself back to it. And when you're really keen and you really, really want to do this, and you know your enthusiasm is boundless, restrain that. Don't get carried away by that. Just bring it back to that consistency, so that you find a consistency on a daily level, whether you feel good or whether you feel bad, whether you want to engage or not engage. That consistency on a daily basis. So if you, as it were, sort of drew a graph in your mind, you're not up one day and then down the next day and then up and then down, and then you're a little bit up and a little bit down. But try and draw with your mental graph, try to draw a straight line that runs consistently day after day. It has no ups and has no downs, but has a consistency that you engage with in all situations, from when you wake up to when you go to sleep. And if you really do work in that direction and really do make that the thing that you want to do in your daily practice, you will find that that takes commitment. That is not easy, because one thing we are not consistent as human beings. We ebb and flow continually. We are pulled by forces continually, negative or positive. And to learn to develop that equanimity in your life, and it's an equanimity towards all formations, if you like, all situations, all formation, which is the middle way. And Buddhism talks of the middle way continually, and it's a deeply, deeply, deeply profound concept, and it's a deeply difficult concept to actually bring into reality. But it's what we do in the practice through this consistency and through the willingness to bear with all of that which will not allow us, determined to not allow us to be consistent. The learning to bear with those forces is the cultivation of the middle way. Is the cultivation of that equanimity towards all of life, all of life's situations, and it's technically known as equanimity towards all formations, which is actually the true and real definition of the Fourth Noble Truth. And when we truly alight on the middle way and have that consistency throughout our day, this is the pinnacle of practice. There's nothing else to do. Stay in that equanimity and bring forth the effort when needed, and hold yourself back when you're getting carried away. And when that truly matures, when it truly matures, you will enter the stream. And with that is the beginning of the end of the suffering. So I don't know if I've said enough there to instigate responses, but we can maybe flesh it out a bit more, because it really does come down, we're actually beginning to, if we embark upon this now, we're really getting to the nitty-gritty, and we're beginning to get in contact with things such as our basic experience of loneliness and separation. And our chattering mind and our habits are always trying to avoid that sense of loneliness and separation. When I'm feeling lonely, I want to go out, I want to do something. I cannot stay with this sense of loneliness. And it's like we almost spend our whole lives avoiding that basic human experience. Fill our lives up with anything, it doesn't matter what it is, as long as we fill our lives and our minds, anything to avoid that loneliness. And anything to avoid that loneliness is avoiding ourselves. And we run around like headless chickens, avoiding ourselves for the whole of our lives. And when we take on this practice, this is what we really start to come up against. And this is a real direct experience in our lives. And it's not a joking business. And this is where we find the difficulties. But ultimately, whether we like it or not, this is what we have to make friends with. We have to open and accept and to make friends. And really look into that sense of separation and that sense of loneliness. Why? Why do I feel lonely? What's the reason for this? I do my best to avoid this and to fill up this space, as it were. And yet I still come back to this sense of separation, this sense of loneliness. Nothing I do seems to ultimately fulfill that desire to get away from this. Why is that? This is all part of the self-discovery. Which is not an easy path. But it's the one that, if we truly wish to go beyond what we don't like, what we know is unwholesome and negative and suffering. This is what we ultimately have to come to grips with, come to know, come to make friends with. So, and I think we can all relate to that to one degree or another, because it's the human condition. And I don't care who you are, it touches all of us to one degree or another. So
you know, which is some loneliness. When I did a solitary some time back, that was the overriding after a while. It was loneliness. I finished after about 3 weeks. And I had a strong sense that if I kept with that practice, it would have slipped into depression even.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder about this challenge where you do sort of experience it fully, but I just had a sense if I just had stayed with it, I would have slipped into something else. And that depression might have lasted with me for I don't know how long, but it was sort of a red flag, I suppose.
But you were experiencing that in a retreat, did you say?
Yes,
a solitary retreat.
Mm.
Well, actually, if you can, that's a very good time to really try to look into that, if you can, because that's an unusual situation, isn't it? When you're on your own, you're away from everything and everyone, and you do get that sense of space, and eventually you think, am I the only one in the world? In those situations, and it does give you the opportunity. I know that it's not easy. It's never easy, but hopefully, you see, when you go in, that's actually a very good point, because very often people within Buddhism like to think, well, if I go, never mind all this what we've been talking about a daily practice, if I go and do my retreat once a year, twice a year, a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, then I can really do my practice, and the rest of the time, well, you know, I'll do my sitting every day, but this daily cultivation is you know, we can't be bothered, we compromise with it, and we say, oh well, that's okay, well, that's what, I'm going on retreat in a couple of weeks, for 2 weeks, I'll be able to do my practice then. So when you go along to a retreat and you actually go from virtually sort of no practice and throw yourself into something that's actually quite intense, that can have quite a negative impact on you. It's the true fruit, the true value of a retreat comes on the back, comes as an extension to your daily practice, so that it's not, you're not going from one extreme to the other, and when you go to that extreme and you get some deep unpleasant experiences like this, you don't know what to do with them because you've not become familiar with them. I'm not saying, I'm using this as a model now, I mean, I'm not getting personal here, but this is what can happen so often, is that we are not familiar with these negative, we avoid them. I'll go and sit, and then, you know, that's my practice. But really, we spend most of our time, even Buddhists, avoiding ourselves. And so you don't get familiar with these. You don't learn to actually get familiar and get to make friends with these things, get to know them, and get to actually see them as not the great threat, the great thing that's going to end up killing me, end up sending me insane. But actually, you begin slowly through that familiarity, you actually begin to get to know them and begin to make friends with them. Now, if you begin to nurture that familiarity day after day after day, until little by little you're actually dealing with your fear, you're dealing with your loneliness, you're dealing with this sense of dukkha. Dukkha doesn't just mean suffering, it has a whole spectrum, and this we live in dukkha perpetually. And through this familiarity, through the containing, through the willingness to stay with ourselves, to bear with ourselves, and not to react to ourselves and run away from the situation, through that familiarity, we begin to approach these things that you talk about, this loneliness and this fear, so that when we go on retreat, and the characteristic of retreat and the quality and the value of retreat is that we actually do things that much more intensive. But we're not doing anything different. We're just putting ourselves in a situation where we can really, really focus more and more and more and not be distracted. And if you go into that retreat with a familiarity of yourself, with a basic understanding of yourself, and knowing yourself that you're like this and you're like, and you've got these fears and you've got these foibles and beginning to actually make friends with all of that, and actually it's not a problem, it's something that I have to make friends with. Once you have that attitude, when you come into a situation as you describe, then you have much more ability, capability of actually staying with it and not be freaked out and not be just carried away by it, because you become familiar with it. It's like it's a friend. It's almost like it becomes a friend. Well, it is a friend, actually. It may not seem like that, but ultimately you do see it as your friend, because it's actually you. It isn't necessarily some dark evil force that's out there that's come to get me and come to drive me crazy. You actually see ultimately that those demons and that darkness and that loneliness is actually you, and you want to actually integrate that and open, and with that openness and with that familiarity, that the whole transforming, the coming together of all of those dark forces. This is we talk about integration, integrated awareness. This is what integration is. We become integrated with the whole of ourselves, not with just the bits that we like. And that retreats have a great value, very, very precious things to experience, but they must come on the back of a daily practice. You can't just sort, as it were, go from 0 to 100 mile an hour. You know, you've got to build up that consistency so that when you actually come to get up to that 100 mile an hour, as it were, you've already become familiar with, you know, speeds slightly less than 100 mile an hour. So it's not a big freak out. You can actually go with it. And that's a very, very important point with retreats. And it's, I think, one of the reasons why I don't talk about it so much, in the same way that I don't put a great emphasis on meditation, because people put all their eggs in this basket. They think it's all about meditation and they think that it's all about retreat. But to me, this is very, very one-sided. This is very, which is actually very incomplete. And to get the true value, of retreats, and not fall into this delusion that I can change, that I can be enlightened and stuff when I go on retreat for the next solitary retreat for the next month. You know, oh gosh, I wonder if I'm going to be enlightened when I'm on my own for a month. This is what people do. This is what we do. We start to focus. We start to think, well, this is what Dharma practice is about. It's about sitting every day, maybe, you know, for the 1 hour, or whatever. And then going on retreat twice a year, they think, well, if I just do those two, that's all I need to do. And I don't believe that that's the case. I think that those two are absolutely very, very important and crucial and very much a part of the package. But the package is not complete until you learn to engage with yourself and get to know yourself and nurture that understanding of yourself on a daily basis. From the moment your consciousness comes to you in the morning, engage with that familiarity with yourself, getting to know yourself and getting to like yourself. Then when you come to do these extra special, come into these extra special circumstances, that includes the sitting, but more so the retreat, when more of yourself, more the depths of yourself come up, the more difficult things come up, you have much more ability to bear with those, stay with those things and understand those things. And it's in the understanding that things turn over and change. And if you do truly get deep insights, or when people do get deep insights on retreat, it's not because of the retreat. That's just like the final straw, as it were, or the final two straws or whatever. All the other straws are cultivated through the rest of your... This is why the Dharma is not a part-time occupation. This is not a part-time hobby. It has to be a total commitment in all situations, in the whole of your being. When you truly nurture that spirit and have that commitment to bring your practice through, without picking and choosing in any way, through the totality of yourself, this is where real change takes place. And it can be very deep and very profound, and it can be permanent. And I think this is why, in many ways, I don't get stuck in talking about meditation a lot, because I know people just like to funnel straight into, oh good, if I go and do my half an hour a day or hour a day and keep doing that every day, I'm going to enter the stream. That won't work.
Is there a notion of degrees of awareness, I suppose, just on a practical level? Practicing getting up in the morning and being aware, I would have a general awareness of myself, as I have a general awareness of myself now.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't necessarily know that this toe is touching this,
yeah,
this piece of material at the time. And I mean, if you read some of the texts, a certain read some of Thich Nhat Hanh, there's a sense that every little movement, every minor movement you're making, that you're aware of, and that seems to be an impossible task. Whereas a general awareness of yourself is, yes, is a possibility, an emotional awareness.
Well, this actually, yes. Well, that's, it's an impossible task, but it's what we were talking about yesterday, that actually you don't have to be perfect, but it's an aspiration, if you like. It's a direction that you move in, but don't think that you have to pull it off. Ultimately, it's your commitment to doing your best is the main thing.
Mm.
And if you are sort of sitting here now, sort of neutrally, feeling neutral, you don't have any particular emotion and stuff that's going on inside of you, then by all means be aware that you're simply sitting here. Be aware that your foot is under your leg, and if you wish, so that you actually are present and you are actually aware. But once that emotion and life, as it were, within ourselves kick in, that definitely is primary. That's alive, that's volatile, there's life there, and energy, and it has that volatility. Who knows where it could go if we're not careful? And it's the learning to stay with that and to keep it and to give it space and make friends with it, because this is you. This is not some alien come to get you. This is you. And until you know yourself completely and wholly, or at least work in that direction, this practice is not complete. And the Dharma needs to be practiced in a complete way, not in a one-sided, what suits me way, i.e. sitting down on my backside once a day. Is not enough. Not enough if you want real change. The value of meditating, you don't have to be sitting too long, and you don't really need that much commitment. You know, you can get quite a lot of happiness, and it can change your life to a degree. You do feel lighter and happier just through doing simple meditational things. Nothing to do with Buddhism. You can just hold after things that you can do, and that's absolutely fine if that's what you want. That's absolutely fine. You don't need to do these things that we're talking about. But in the scheme of things, that is very, very superficial, and it's also subject to change. And once you stop, once you lose that, you'll probably fall back into your old ways, because these things don't go away that easily. We have to work at it. So it's all degrees, and the more that you can bring it into the totality of your life's experience, that's where the real change takes place, the real one. And that's very, as I say, you know, I know Thich Nhat Hanh and several of them say these are sort of exercises to bring you back to yourself. But it's not like the real thing. That's like the preparatory, if you like, is to have that awareness. But when you have that awareness, that then has to start to work, start to look into, start to cut into samsara, into ignorance, into delusion, into why we are bound with this suffering. And you can't do that until you have this self-awareness is established. So all these little exercises that so many of these people do and offer people, encourage people to do, are really preparatory things. It's actually just to nurture that self-awareness that you have a body and you have a mind and you're here. This is what they're working to encourage people to do. But ultimately, you've got to go deeper than that if you really want to cut the bonds of samsara. It's not enough to know that your foot is on the floor. It has to go deeper than that.
What's the most difficult emotion that you've had to deal with in integrating your consciousness?
Me personally?
Yeah.
I would say over the years, as generalisation, looking back over the years, I suppose probably my sexual drive is the most consistent and incredibly powerful, but it's also the consistency of it, is that it just seems to be there or thereabouts, whereas lots of other things tend to come and go and what have you. That fellow seems to hang around most of the time. and certainly, you know, bringing that up from my point of view, I've very much used that as a vehicle to insight, as my vehicle to get to know myself. Because it is incredibly powerful and it's totally, totally logical. It's got an ounce of sense in it, really, when you look at it.
It's totally illogical.
Illogical. Incredibly destructive. Incredibly negative. But totally unavoidable. And it just will not go away.
It's a
wonderful thing to look into. Hmm?
Why is that totally negative?
That's going too far. In and of itself, it's okay. It's what it is, and it's absolutely fine. And, you know, we can all get a buzz off of it. But what it can do is that it can create so much negativity in your life and things with other people. And somehow it is really difficult. It seems almost inevitable that if you go down that road, it always ends up in some sort of a disaster in the end. I'm sure it doesn't have to be. I'm sure it doesn't. I'm sure it doesn't have to be, but you know, I think this is one of the reasons why in Buddhism and in religions and spiritualities that this is the one area of ourselves that we have to be incredibly careful with. Because it can lead us, it can really take us down. And without doubt, it definitely is something of the realm of the lower man. And it's something that will definitely take you down. It won't nurture the higher man, the spiritual man. But having said that, again, we have to make friends with that. We can't get in conflict with ourselves because, you know, we get turned on easily and we get carried away easily. That too is a trap that we can actually make a problem of that. We have to make friends with that also and learn to contain that and learn to look at why? You know, what's going on here? You know, it's madness. And it's like it's there and it really is probably the most basic thing within us. And it goes way beyond our consciousness and our logic. But still it's undeniable and it's there, but you can actually use it. So you don't have to deny it. Contain it like you contain everything, like we have to contain. It's no different than anything else in the sense of containing, of practice and ethics, of considering other people and all of those things. The same we do with other aspects of ourselves. So we contain it, but we learn to look into it and not to make a problem out of it. And again, the more we look into, the more we understand, the deeper we can go into it. The more it will lose its power, and that too will go into change. But I think it's probably the most dangerous vehicle of the lot, because of its immense power, and I think what's even more important than the power is and I've really seen this in myself, within that experience, the self-identity is at its most powerful. And I think that when we get down to it, I think that's what we're talking about. The sense of me is ground in that, deeper and stronger than any other aspect. That's my own
sense of self.
Yeah, this makes me more alive than anything else. This gives me a sense that I exist more than any other aspect of my personality. And I think, as I said earlier, I think we engage in things continually as an affirmation of ourselves. I am here. This is me. We can go bungee jumping. That's all bungee jumping is affirming me, that the adrenaline, the buzz of jumping off a cliff or whatever, is nothing more than an affirmation of me. I exist. That's all it is. And I think, I think the sexual thing is in my experience for me, and it probably isn't the same for everybody, there is more sense of me. David is alive and kicking when that thing is on fire.
So would you say that with children, like that's just another affirmation of one? So you're part of the wheel.
Having children. Well, that's. Well, having children is obviously a natural thing to do. It's a natural thing in nature.
So sex.
But yeah, absolutely. And like I said, there's nothing wrong with sex. There's nothing, but it's our relationship with it, and it's our attachment, if you wish, and that's our grasping, and the same with children. It's the grasping and the attachment. That's the kids in and of themselves are okay. They're neutral and they're empty. It's the same as everything else in life is neutral and empty. We create a world. We make the problem. We make the mountain out of the molehill. This powerful attachment that we get. And when we get attached, as a simple basic rule of anything, when we get attached, we create problems. We make mountains. It's simple. That goes for everything. It so happens that that particular part of us is immensely powerful. And therefore, I think it's the most dangerous vehicle. But I think, well, I've always used it, and it's something that we can all take on board.
So you said you used it as a kind of main driving force inside into yourself. How have you used that then?
Just to learn to understand myself and why this happens. Why? I know that if I start to engage in a particular situation, I know almost invariably it's going to end up, you know, as a bit of a mess. And yet somehow it seems it's unavoidable. You still do it. Well, the middle way in everything is to engage in life, and this is a part of life, and it's a great thing. But it is about non-attachment. The more you can get possessed by it, the more you can engage and enjoy it and then let it go. This is the thing at the end of it. It's not the thing itself. It's letting go of all that at the end, rather than get this emotional, neurotic attachments that come out of that thing. And that's where the problem is. That's nothing to do with sex. That's to do with your relationship with it. And that's a completely different thing altogether. And that's where the self is. And that's where that more than anything, we were just talking about loneliness and separation. That's the thing that we think is going to take care of that part of us more than anything. And this can be part of the whole insightful process, but you've got to be so careful with it. And this is why all spiritual practices are very wary, and this is why celibacy is demanded in many practices and in Buddhism. Maybe not with us, but you know, there are plenty of schools and, you know, monks and people.
Yeah,
they're not allowed any engagement.
The main alternative, you know, it's like what's put forward is like, you know, I've yet to hear real solutions to kind of that drive in people. Besides, well, just leave it alone.
Yeah. Well, it is about containment. It is about discipline. It is about. It's like everything else. It's like tethering the wild animal. You do keep, as best as you can, keep it in check, so that it becomes as less destructive as you can actually make it. But that goes for everything within you. And learn to look into that. And learn. I mean, for me, I could see that this is where David was really, really alive, more than any other situation. And that just made such much. In many ways, that settled so many of these questions, so many of the paradoxes, so much of the unavoidable engagement with it is because it makes me feel alive. And in that knowing, that's where you can just nurture that and go deeper and deeper, and then you begin to let go of it more and more, not through aversion, but through understanding. you let go of it, you let go of it. And when you're truly wise, when you truly understand, you let go of all of life, because you see attachment is where suffering comes from. And that ultimately is no different than your attachment to a cup of tea, ultimately, just that one happens to be more powerful than another. I must have a cup of tea. Give me a cup of tea, and if there's no tea there, I get angry, I can upset people, and you know, that's your reaction to the situation. You are creating that world. If there's no tea there, oh dear, I would like to have a cup of tea, but there isn't a cup of tea. I will accept it, and I will just live with, you know, this is life, isn't it? We don't always get what we want, not make a problem out of it. But fundamentally, your attachment to a cup of tea and your reaction to a cup of tea and your attachment to a cup of tea and the negativity that comes from that attachment is actually no different than that sexual thing. Fundamentally, everything comes back to the same, all paths lead to the same centre. Whatever our own particular worlds are, whatever the world is that we create, all comes back to that same fundamental thing. But there's so much, and I thoroughly accept that the attention that's given to this whole subject, say within Buddhism, to be very, very careful of it, is quite justified, because it can be the most destructive thing. And when it becomes destructive, there is nothing in that for anybody, is there? We all suffer from that. Nobody gets anything out of it. So then be very, very careful. What time's tea?
What tea was at 11, yes.
Earlier, giving the ideal form really of learning to do the containing practice is through a daily routine, ideally, but of course not everybody has a daily routine. People have occupations and live their lives without a routine. A daily routine, but of course that doesn't exclude them. The Dharma isn't for people who go to work every day. It's actually for everybody. But even if you look at people like monks, you say, well, you know, they don't work. They have routines. They have, providing the monastery is authentic and working properly. You know, they'll have times. Their time to get up, their time for meditation, their time for breakfast, for work, and etc. Whatever it is. So they, you know, even people like that who aren't sort of engaged in a normal job, shall we say.